the weight of their bodies, just shy of a dozen zombies leaning against the bars, twisted the door around and tore it free of the second hinge. They spilled out, like lions into an arena, staggering toward M with a speed that seemed somehow beyond them. He attempted to use his rifle as a club, but more than half of them fell upon him, including his brother-in-law E, and dragged him to the floor. That I have taken the time to describe these events in any detail is not meant to imply that I was pausing to observe them. As M's rifle went off, I pulled open the door to the stairs. A glance back showed me the tide of zombies and my hired man's final fate. A quartet of my former captives stumbled past the gruesome feast and toward me. I briefly considered going back to close the door behind me, certain it would provide a fair barrier for a few minutes. But my fear overwhelmed me, and I raced up the steps to my medical theater, chased by the screams of M. There, I slammed the door, fumbling through my pockets for the key that served its lock. Only a minute after the bolt shot home, came a thick noise, the sound of something senseless striking the door. The impact came again and again, as the zombies shuffled on the stairs, each slamming itself against the slats of wood. My mind was not functioning properly. In retrospect, I can say this. Rather than reinforcing the door, my only thoughts were destruction and escape, and I looked about the theater for the means of both. A spare lantern, unlit, rested on a hook until I hurled it to shatter at the base of the door, and was rewarded with a liquid sound of lamp oil flowing down the cellar steps. I raced to the back room and returned with two bottles of cleaning alcohol, and threw these beneath the trembling door as well. The Franklin stove nearest the basement was fired, and I used the tongs to draw a blazing lump of coal from the hearth, sending it at the door with a swing of my arms. The fiery stone struck the planks and set the spills ablaze, washing flames up over the wood, and I was rewarded with a large rushing noise from behind the door, followed by a wash of light from between the slats and the acrid smells of burning flesh and hair. Yet my joy was short-lived, for the pounding, the relentless pounding on the door did not stop. Even as the fires grew and the wood blackened, it shook the frame, sending charred splinters across the theater. I scampered back, away from the inferno, scuttling across the floorboards like a terrified hound with his tail between his legs. And well I did, for moments later, the weakened door crumbled beneath the mindless blows of its prisoners. The first zombie through the savage hole, already a charred nightmare of bone, gristle, and flaming hair, stumbled halfway across the threshold. One of the remaining slats, now a fire-hardened spear, slipped up through its stomach and out its back, pinning it like a grotesque black insect in a collection of horrors. The next through tripped over the first, sprawling across the floor next to the table I'd used many times now to put these creatures at rest. A third tried to step across, but leaned too far and fell back, taking a fourth and a fifth with it as it tumbled back down the steps into the basement, now as much an oven as the Franklin stove here in the main room. The second zombie crawled toward me, rising to her feet, her blind eyes staring at me. Yes, her. Fate had seen fit to bring the Negress and I back together, now on more even terms, if not weighed in her favor. She had somehow escaped the worst of the flames, singeing her hair and flesh, bubbling her skin in places, charring her dress to a few fragments of ash. She reached for me with her claws, now torn and rife with large splinters, and I continued to slide and stumble away. We gained our feet at the same moment, giving me a slight advantage. As my mind was still preoccupied with destructive thoughts, the animalistic need to kill or be killed, I found myself grabbing the coal shovel and brandishing it in both hands. I thrust it forward even as the woman's stagger became an awkward lunge, and by the divine guidance of the Lord, the thin edge of the shovel passed through her throat and between two vertebrae, severing her head from her body. The skull bounced away, hair swishing in the air, even as her body dropped in a heap. As I stood flush with victory, with survival, the magnitude of my situation became apparent in the lucidity that followed. The flames were spreading, destroying all evidence of my crime, but also all of my work as well. I realized the folly my secretive labors had caused here, and vowed it would not be in vain. Ere the flames spread too far, I made a quick circuit of the theater and the back room, retrieving my notes and journals, along with a number of other rarities, instruments, and special volumes that would not easily be replaced. I thought of the intellectual treasures burning in the basement, and cursed my selfish pride once again. A few last items were grabbed and stowed in my bags, and I slipped away to my apartments. The building burned throughout the night, and by all account, alas, none of the zombies escaped. I say alas, for, you see, the discovery of almost 24 charred, unidentified bodies in the basement of the medical theater, so soon after the newspaper article of the missing vagrants, made a solid case against me in the eyes of the local inspector. Add in the number of gnawed bones found among the remains, and the naked, headless body of the negress that survived the bulk of the fire, and I swiftly became a folk legend on par with the greatest bogey or goblin. Dr. W. tried to preserve my name as long as he could, but at last even he was forced to admit that all the evidence pointed to my apparently deep and twisted dementia. I, of course, was witness for none of this. The same night I fled the medical theater, I abandoned my apartments after the briefest of visits. In less than an hour, my trunks, bags, and hatbox were packed, my affairs put in order, and a private carriage arranged. I traded carriages at the next town, and then again in Whitechapel, before finally ensconcing myself at a less than reputable hotel near the docks. 3 days later, I boarded this ship headed for Virginia. I had only to mention an earthy scandal involving both the wife and daughter of a nobleman, and the captain laughingly agreed to log my passage under another name in exchange for the tale, thus adding to the levels of subterfuge and intrigue between me and the good inspector. We have been at sea for 2 weeks, and the Americas grow close. From there, I shall use my remaining funds to charter passage to Haiti, where I shall purchase lodging and attempt to begin my studies again. With the aid and support of the local populace, it is my belief that the mystery and nature of the zombie may be solved. For, God willing, if the stories of S are to be believed, I shall be treated as a great man on that island, a Bukor, once they see the thing that still rustles and moves her jaws within my hatbox.
The Apocrypha of Gamma 202. The gold-rimmed china had been cleared away, the after-dinner drinks poured, and Gamma 202, as usual, had turned the conversation to religion. The newer model had been gone for a long time, and his old friends each had a silent chuckle at his eagerness to pick up debates they had left off a decade ago.
"Honestly, Gam," said Father Omega 540L, his old religious studies instructor, "it was such a handful before, and travel hasn't helped in the slightest." The old priest's head was a great clear dome that ran shoulder to shoulder, filled with gleaming circuits and the occasional brilliant spark. It was difficult for him to find clothes that fit.
"Look, I'm not trying to offend anyone," Gam said for the third time, "but we're all supposed to be rational, intelligent people. It's just sad to return home and find not one of you has changed a bit since I last saw you."
As he returned to the study, Dr. Zeta 736 paused to adjust his cravat in the hallway mirror. He admired his reflection for a moment. Once, centuries ago, he had been a new model, like Gam. Now the once bright gold of his dome had darkened to a respectable bronze. All the polish in the world wouldn't bring back that brilliant luster of newness, even with a good power buffer. Zeta sighed,
a buzzing noise like a long zipper, and poured himself a drink from the cart the housekeeper had left them.
"And you think believing in man isn't rational?"
The local alderman, Pi Sigma 399, pulled a pipe from his jacket and a small pouch of anthracite dust. Pi was almost 7 centuries old and had never been able to break his smoking habit, no matter how often he was told it would shorten his lifespan. He sat across from the priest, the chessboard between them decorated with the second game of the evening.
"I've always thought any blind belief isn't rational," said Gam as he paced around the room, "be it weather, dice, or man."
"The problem with you newer models is you've never actually read the directory," grumbled Father Om.
He sipped his own glass of coolant, a fine vintage from one of the southern distilleries, and tapped his claw-like digits on the glass. His old design left the delicate pistons and gears of his hand exposed, and they shifted and danced within the structure of his palm. He usually wore gloves to protect them from the elements, but he liked the feel of the chess pieces against his bare fingers.
"You pick and choose words to prove your point without reading the whole thing."
"That's funny, sir," Gam said with a smile. "I was about to say the same thing about you older models."
Pi chuckled.
"I'm sure you were. Look, my young friend, until you've actually taken the effort to read the whole directory cover to cover in the original binary, any point you may have is questionable at best."
Gem wagged an emphatic digit at the alderman.
"Don't you see, though? That is my point. The directory, as read by most people, isn't in the original binary. It's been downloaded, file-swapped, translated to hexadecimal, and more. There are dozens of errors that could have entered the original file, which, I might add, was also created by a robot. Man did not come down from the heavens and upload the directory to the first robot."
They sighed and shook their heads. Pi took the moment to light his pipe and let the scalding smoke work its way through his systems. Zeta smiled at Gam and raised his glass in a silent toast. They both drank.
"Man is eternal," said Father Om, each word carrying the weight of countless repetitions.
He reached out a digit and pushed his rook forward 3 spaces.
"The directory is the names of man, and through his names we know him."
Across the board, the alderman bowed his head in agreement.
"All praise the 16 million names."
Then he reached out and took the rook with his bishop. Om grumbled and tapped his fingers against his glass. Pi turned his attention back to Gam.
"You've always had dangerous ideas," he said, pointing the stem of his pipe at the younger model. "You must learn not to share them so openly. You can't fall back on being new anymore. It's time to start acting responsibly."
"And what would be considered responsible?" asked Gam. "Ignoring conflicts and data discrepancies?"
"Of course not," said Zeta.
He saw Om reach for a pawn, gave a subtle shake of his head, and pointed at a knight. The father's eyes brightened, and he nodded. The alderman tapped a few more grains of coal into the bowl of his pipe.
"Dear man," he said with a smile. "Gone 11 years, Gam, and on our first night together, you're already boring me again."
"Then it's good that everything else I have to say is interesting. Something happened during my grand tour, and I wanted to share it with the three of you first."
"What a wonderful opening," said Zeta.
"You see before you a unit remade," Gam said. He spread his arms dramatically before the fireplace. "When I left for my grand tour, I was a skeptic. I picked apart each entry of the directory and challenged every belief each of you presented me with."
"A polite way of remembering it," said Om. "And now?"
"Now," said Gam, "I have found man."
"You what?"
asked Zeta. Pi coughed up a cloud of coal smoke.
"You're pulling our legs."
"Not at all," Gam said. "I'm a believer. More than that, man's existence is an inarguable fact."
"Travel broadens the mind," said Om with a nod and 3 firm taps
on the side table.
"I've always said it."
"You're more right than you know, old friend."
"So where did you end up going?"
asked Zeta.
We must know where to send all the other new heretics to bring them around.
Nymerica.
Silence fell across the room. Gam took the moment to refill his drink from the decanter. He had a sip, and then let his gaze drift back to the elders.
You shouldn't say such things,
said Father Ohm with a glance at the alderman.
Even joking about it could get you into trouble.
I'm not joking, my friends.
Pye clenched his pipe in his hand.
Man, damn you, lad! What were you thinking?
I wasn't thinking, I was exploring.
How could you even get to Nymerica?
Asked Pye.
There are no trains, no aircraft.
I walked.
Now I know you're mad. It would take years.
It did. Almost 2 years, each way.
So, you're telling us...
Zeta set his drink down and crossed his arms.
You're telling us you really went to Nymerica?
Gam took another sip of his coolant. He gave the room a satisfied smile.
I did.
There aren't even interweb nodes. You'd have been completely cut off.
As I was. For 7 years. That's when I found man.
Well, no wonder,
said Pye. He nudged one of his pawns onto a new space.
All those years cut off from everything.
Father Arm nodded in agreement.
Solitude and reflection makes believers of us all,
he said.
I remember meditating once on a passage translated from the Queen Nye version of the directory, and after several weeks it occurred to me that...
You misunderstood me, sirs, Gam said. I wasn't speaking spiritually or figuratively. I said I found man during my time in Nymerica, and I meant it.
They all stared at him. Another silence dragged down the sounds in the room. Even the fireplace seemed to grow quiet.
What are you saying?
Asked the alderman. Gam beamed at them.
I have found the physical remains of man.
Physical remains? Echoed Zeta. You're mistaken, surely.
I am not.
Preposterous,
said Father Ohm. He used his queen to bat away one of Pye's bishops. The piece clattered on the floor.
Utter nonsense.
Zeta stooped to gather up the fallen bishop. Gamma 202, he said, careful to use his friend's full, formal name.
Why don't you explain yourself? Start from the beginning.
Gam nodded and had another swallow of coolant.
I'd decided early on to make my way to Nymerica. I couldn't find any maps or guides.
For good reason,
said Pye. Zeta hushed him with a gesture, and the alderman settled back in his chair.
I couldn't find any maps, Gam said. So I had to go off the grid, so to speak, and find my own path. I traveled west, across the southern Talandic chemical swamps, spent 3 months walking around a chasm that went down for miles, and then I reached the shores of Nymerica. I saw all the places of legend. I walked through the great glass desert of D.C., stared at the empty wastelands of Nye. Nymerica's an amazing and terrifying place, an entire continent swept clean. After a year, when I reached the pacifist coast, I turned and walked back on a different path, back and forth. Back and forth, I didn't want to miss anything. On my third western trip, I crossed the ashlands of Okloma. A shift of the ground sent me tumbling down to the bottom of a hill. I wasn't paying attention, and the dirt was loose and dry. I dusted myself off, started to get to my feet, and the ground gave way again. This time, I plunged straight down at least 20 feet into an old cavern of some kind. I lay there for a few minutes, making sure I hadn't been damaged in the fall. I had awful thoughts of being trapped thousands of miles from home, waiting for my batteries to run down. Then I finished my checks and realized a torn sleeve and a broken boot heel were my worst injuries.
You're a lucky fool, said Zeta.
Pye and Father Ohm nodded in agreement. So did Gam himself.
It was dark, but my eyes adjusted. As the details around me grew, I realized the cavern was actually a manufactured chamber. Countless years had turned the concrete ceiling into a forest of stalactites. Layers of rubble, sand, and dust had made the floor rough and uneven. The hole in the ceiling was well out of my reach. A few minutes of exploration revealed a few other tunnels. Maybe they'd been hallways once. I was in some kind of entryway, an antechamber that led to different rooms. I couldn't sense any air currents or light, so I chose a corridor at random and began to search. I found several rooms. Time and geology had taken their tolls, but I could make out simple instruments and machines, sometimes items of furniture. After a few hours, it was clear. I was in a vast complex, a shelter of some kind. Even more amazing, as I examined the furniture and the height of some wall-mounted artifacts and inscriptions, it all appeared to be built for beings much like ourselves. They clearly had a similar size and structure, and at least some of the same senses. "I'd been in the complex for 2 days," continued Gam, "and mapped out 50 rooms. I found what seemed to be an exit, but it was blocked by a collapsed roof and several support beams. It would take a month at least to dig it clear, assuming I had enough strength to move some of the heavier debris pieces, so I decided to keep searching the complex in hopes of finding a more direct exit. And 2 days later, I found it."
Ohm tapped his thin digits on the chessboard. "The exit?"
Gam shook his head. "It was in another room, spread out on some kind of platform. A section of the ceiling had collapsed, and a large chunk of concrete had crushed most of what lay there. The scraps of fabric that covered it crumbled at my gentlest touch. Beneath was a substructure of struts and supports that appeared to be made of some porous ceramic. The intact ones were dry and brittle. I was trying to deduce what manner of machine would have such a structure when I noticed the lump at the end of the platform. At first, layered as it was in dust and grit, I'd mistaken it for another piece of concrete, pitted with age. Then I noticed how similar the two largest holes were, and once I did, the symmetry of the whole piece was apparent."
The alderman's pipe had gone out. He made no move to relight it.
"What are you getting at?"
"It was a head," said the younger model. "The struts, the framework, it was all the remains of an ancient body."
"Nonsense," Father Ohm said.
"I don't think a robot's ever been made with a ceramic endoskeleton," said Zeta. "Your first thoughts were probably right. It was just a piece of concrete with an interesting—"
"It was man," Gam said. "A real physical being who existed in the time before robots."
Father Ohm shook his head and turned back to the chessboard.
"Nonsense," he repeated. "Nonsense that borders on blasphemy."
Pi nodded in agreement and went back to studying the pieces around his remaining bishop.
"It was just your mind playing tricks on you."
"It wasn't."
"It's a common phenomenon," said Zeta. "When isolated and cut off from input, the mind creates images it wants to—"
"I thought so too at first," said Gam with a quick nod. "But as the days went on, I discovered more of them. I was down in that shelter for 9 days before I found an air shaft that led back to the surface. In that time, I found 7 bodies, each with slight variations that couldn't be attributed to damage or age. 2 of them were half the size of the others."
Father Ohm muttered something and slid one of his pawns forward.
"I wasn't hallucinating," Gam said. "They were real. Man was real. Not as some fantastic multi-named deity, but as a species. Don't you see? There was no one man. There were many, hundreds, perhaps even thousands. They were a race, like us."
"I'm sure it seemed that way at the time," Zeta said. "But once you look back, you'll see it was just a bunch of stones."
"No, I won't," said the younger model. "And neither will any of you."
Pi's hand froze just above his remaining bishop.
"I beg your pardon."
Gam smiled at them. A few quick strides carried him out to the hall. He returned with his satchel. It was a threadbare bag of patched polyester corduroy, a student's bag. He set it on the other reading table.
"What do you have?" asked Zeta.
Gam opened his satchel, lifted out something wrapped in a handkerchief, and set it on the table. It was more or less round and several inches across.
"Out of all 7,
The first one I discovered was the most complete, he explained. He peeled away the layers of thin cotton to reveal the object. It was closer to oval than round. As he described, the sockets were large and symmetrical. A triangular opening sat between and below them. Loops on either side could have held part of another structure. Two thick seams like mold lines crossed over the top. Zeta gazed at the empty sockets.
I thought you said the remains were too brittle to move.
They were, Gam said. Once I realized what I'd found, I knew drastic measures were needed.
What did you do? Asked Pi. The game had been forgotten again as he turned to study the artifact.
The younger model shifted on his feet.
I mixed my emergency sealant into my coolant reservoir. It made the sealant thin enough to spray so I could coat the remains. Six layers made it solid enough to move.
And endangered your own life, said Zeta, looking up at Gam. That must have been most of your reserve.
I've been careful, said the younger model. It was worth the risk.
Without that sealant, one leak could have cooked your processor. Tell me you've had your levels restored since you got back.
He held up his glass and gave the doctor a tight grin.
I'm working on it.
I'm serious, Gam. I'll need to see you first thing tomorrow.
Forget about me, he said. Don't you realize what this is? What this means for all of us? It will change everything.
If I had a dollar for every time I've heard that, said Pi. You haven't been spouting these silly theories to anyone else, have you?
Not yet, said Gam. I wanted to share it with all of you first.
Well, there's that, then, said Father Om. He set his last bishop down hard. The golden piece clicked against the board. Check and mate.
Pi turned back to the board.
So it is, you cunning old bastard. I'd say that means it's time to call it a night.
He stood and tapped out his pipe in the fireplace.
I have services in the morning,
said the priest as he reset the chessboard.
Doesn't look good if I'm the one yawning.
Please, said Gam, gesturing at the relic. Just look at it.
Zeta and Pi helped Father Om out of his chair. The old robot's joints wheezed and hissed as he straightened up.
A pleasure, as always, he said to Zeta. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming.
Gam, said Pi. It was amusing as always. Good to have you back.
The younger model watched as the priest and alderman pulled on coats and gloves. Hats and scarves were set in place, walking sticks taken in mechanical hands. Zeta exchanged farewells with them and they headed out into the night.
Zeta, said the younger model, please tell me you understand what this is, what it means.
The doctor looked at his old student.
Let's have a nightcap, he said.
He walked past the relic to the drinks cart.
No, said Gam. I don't want another drink. I want you to look at this.
Zeta flipped over two fresh glasses and selected a bottle. Then he glanced over his shoulder and reconsidered.
You might need something a little stronger, he said.
I said I don't want another drink.
Doctor's orders, said Zeta. You have a drink. I'll take a good long look at this ceramic head of yours.
He handed a glass to Gam and raised his own.
Cheers.
Cheers.
They drank, and Zeta bent to look at the object. He took a step to the left, then another. He crouched to stare into the sockets. One finger stretched out and brushed the brow ridge. Gam swallowed half his drink in one gulp.
Well?
It is fascinating, he said. There's no question in your mind what this is.
Absolutely none, the doctor nodded. I just don't understand why the others weren't interested, said Gam. Why they just left without even examining the evidence.
They all left, said Zeta. Because they dislike the unpleasant work, that's my job.
He straightened up and looked away from the artifact. Gam finished his drink and set it down next to the chessboard.
Is it something I could help with? It seems like the least I could do since you're the only one who believes me.
Ah, my friend, said the doctor. That's the unpleasantness. They all believed you.
They did?
Not just believed. They knew you were right.
He gestured at the artifact.
It's called a cranium, or a skull, depending on context. The material is bone. It is the endoskeletal head of a man.
Gam perked up.
A man, he repeated. You acknowledge there was more than one?
Of course there was, Zeta said. The younger model glanced at the front door the elders had vanished through.
Why didn't you say something?
What was there to say? We'd all hoped you'd matured, that you'd grown out of your obsessions.
Zeta shook his head.
Did you even stop once to think what your truth would mean for the world? Or did you just race back with that thing wrapped up in your handkerchief, determined to be right?
I don't understand. Facts are facts. Why does it matter?
Gam took a step and the room whirled. His gyros seemed to be off and his optics refused to focus.
What?
Zeta looked at him and rolled his shoulders.
I'm sorry, he said.
What did you...
A mild acid in your drink. Externally, you'd never even notice it, but internally it will corrode several of the finer contacts in your processor.
Zeta picked up the glass and tossed it into the fireplace. The crystal tumbler shattered against the bricks and tumbled down into the gas jets.
Most likely it's something you came in contact with in Nymerica, made worse by your decision to empty 4/5 of your coolant system. Cruel irony that it didn't affect you until you were home. Lucky for you, too.
Gam took another step, tilted, and fell against the couch. His head hit the hard frame at the top, but he barely felt it. He tried to roll over into a sitting position, but his limbs were weak and sluggish.
It won't destroy your brain, said the doctor, but it will require extensive surgery to fix. Everyone will be so happy you survived that no one will question any changes to your personality or gaps in your memory.
The younger model managed to roll himself over, his body slumped across the cushions, but he faced his old friend. They stared at each other for a moment.
You and the others don't want to lose your power.
The doctor shook his head.
You're so far from the truth.
The truth is right there.
Gam's eyes flitted to the bone relic on the table.
Yes, said Zeta. And the truth is that man is dead. Man ceased to exist in his great wars. There was no ascension, no journey to the stars. Our creators are nothing but dust and bones.
Gam's vision was fading. His left optic had dissolved into static. The view from the right was fuzzy. He tried to speak, but his speech circuits were unresponsive. He dug deep for a subroutine or emergency protocol and managed to get out one word.
Why?
The older model reached out and ran a gentle digit along the smooth top of the artifact.
Think of the millions who'd be shattered by such a revelation, that everything in our society is based on, that everything they have ever believed is no more than a fairy tale.
He shook his burnished head.
We have maintained the lie this long. We shall continue to maintain it for the foreseeable future.
Zeta wrapped his fingers around the skull and squeezed. The artifact crumbled into bits and powder. He gathered up the edges of the handkerchief, pinched the ends between his fingers, and swung the bundle into the fireplace.
Try to relax, he said. I'm going to go call for an ambulance. This will all be over soon.
He paused at the door and glanced back into the study. The younger model had seized up. His limbs were stiff. His eyes had gone dark.
It's good to have you back, Gam.
Dead men can't complain. Mr. Secord? Said the voice. Mr. Secord, can you hear me? He felt his eyes moving, but a red veil hid everything.
Yeah, I can.
Okay, that's good. Hang on, let me open your eyes. Something pressed against his face and the world exploded into existence, carried on waves of white light.
Oh, jeez. Jeez, that's bright.
Sorry, we need it for the vision test. Can you see okay?
The brilliance dimmed, and an Asian man loomed over him, inches from his face. He leaned back and revealed a loose tie and white coat. Behind the doctor was a spectacled blonde in hospital scrubs. Her curly hair was pulled back into a high ponytail, almost a topknot.
Yeah, fine. Where am...
His lungs ran low and he coughed.
Deep breath. Just think about doing it. There you go. What color's my tie?
Red.
How many fingers?
Two.
And now?
4,
he wheezed. Don't forget to breathe. And now?
2 again.
Excellent. Can you make a fist? Good. Other hand? Good. Hold on to this pen as tight as you can. Very good.
Where am I? Am I in the hospital?
Just a few more quick tests, Mr. Secord. Can you feel this? How about this?
Yeah, that.
Incredible. Do you know the year?
It's 2109. Unless I've been out for a really long time. May 17th.
It's the 18th, actually. You've been gone for a day. What's your name?
Lawrence. Homer Lawrence Secord.
Birthday?
Last month. April 28th. I'm 44.
Who's the president?
Wesley Lohan. Vice president is Jeffrey Maguire.
Very good. You a political man?
Diehard Whig.
Ah. Lawrence raised an eyebrow.
Why, ah.
This'll probably be rough on you. What's the last thing you remember? He mulled over the gray images in his head until he found a colorful one.
I was at work.
Where's that?
Dynotech. I'm a portfolio specialist.
And then?
I headed home. I'm supposed to go to some cocktail party with my wife.
He grinned. Guess I got out of that. The doctor smirked. Yes, you did. Do you remember what happened next?
I drove home. I always do.
You drive a classic, right?
Yeah, a Tesla. I'm gonna miss that car.
Right, nodded the doctor. And?
Oh. Oh, hell. Somebody hit me. Some jerk in a truck.
It was a bus, actually. You tried to cross the busway and got hit by the green line.
Oh, son of a... Am I... Wait. You did all those tests. I made it out. I'm okay.
You're lucky, that's for sure, nodded the doctor. These days only one person in 1,000 still carries the X virus, and only 1 out of 1,000 of those has strain 17.
What?
You almost didn't make it. The windshield practically decapitated you. If one of the residents hadn't run a blood test, we would have just shipped your body off to the incinerator. The blonde smiled and gave a little wave.
What are you saying? You did the tests. I'm okay, right?
He wiggled his fingers and toes to find the unspoken problem. The Asian man nodded. You're fine. You made the transition with no apparent loss of mental ability.
The transition? What are you talking about?
The doctor held his hand back and the blonde placed a mirror in it. This may be a bit of a shock, but it's best just to get it over with. The H. Lawrence Secord in the mirror looked a bit pale, and his hair was messy. There were a few small cuts on his forehead, but none of them were bleeding. His eyes looked black, and he realized the pupils were wide open. Then he turned his chin and saw his throat. Stitches ran around his neck, coarse black threads coated with gummy blood. He could still see the raw, ragged gash that ran across his Adam's apple and out of sight behind him. The edges were pushed together and caked with dried gore. The skin above the wound was a shade paler than the flesh below it. You're dead, Mr. Secord, said the doctor. But you had the X-virus, so you came back. You're a zombie now.
Life challenged,
murmured the resident. Right, nodded the doctor. Whatever. Lawrence flipped through his billfold.
Someone took all my cash. He growled. What kind of place is this?
Hospital policy,
the resident explained. It's how they cover costs for any repairs and orientation.
Are you insane? Give me my money back and send me a bill.
She shook her head.
Sorry. They have to do it this way.
Why?
You'll understand soon enough.
She guided him down a delivery hallway away from the other patients. The staff members they passed stared at him.
What's that supposed to mean?
Look, let me give you a couple of tips, okay? Off the record.
She looked around and patted his thigh.
Probably about this time tomorrow your legs are going to feel stiff and swollen. Your feet are going to hurt. That's lividity setting in.
What?
Without your heart pumping, all your blood and bodily fluids are going to drain down. You're still moving around, so that'll force some capillary action, but not much.
She pushed a bright blue scalpel into his hand. It was sealed in a sterile wrapper.
You'll want to slit your ankles on either side of the Achilles tendon and let everything drain out. Cut up and down. Go as deep as you can, but make it clean. Remember, you don't heal anymore, so if you cut the Achilles, you'll cripple yourself. Shake your legs a lot. You probably want to do it in the shower or outdoors. It's going to be messy.
Okay.
Second thing is to keep clean. You don't want to rot. Rub yourself down with alcohol whenever you can. Don't forget to do your eyes, ears, nostrils, and your rectum. Drink some of it, too, but not too much.
Oh, jeez.
You'll want to buy some Lysol or some kind of antiseptic spray. It'll help keep bacteria away and hide your smell. Oh, and some eye drops. Your eyes are going to be the biggest challenge. You might want to consider contacts to use as protective covers.
This is some kind of joke, right? This is all a sick...
He ran out of air again and had to will himself to inhale.
Third, don't try to eat anything that isn't raw meat. Chicken, fish, shellfish, doesn't matter what. But if you try to eat anything cooked or processed, you're just going to throw it back up again.
I can't eat raw meat.
The double doors clanged open and they were outside on the loading dock. The sun was heading down. The resident's owlish glasses flared. Her hair looked like gold in the afternoon light.
You don't have a choice,
she told him.
If you don't, you're going to last a year at best, and half of that'll be pretty miserable. Be thankful you've got enough brains left to control your appetite.
I don't, he closed his eyes. What else?
Last thing. San Diego's not a good place for your kind.
What do you mean?
He growled.
My kind.
For ex-humans,
she said.
It's not a good climate, temperature-wise. The heat breeds bacteria. Think about moving somewhere with real winters, but not so cold you'll freeze.
She glanced around and held out a 50.
Take this. It should get you home. Hillcrest, right?
Yeah. I'm still trying to process all this.
Your family, they Whigs, too?
Of course.
Well, maybe things will go well for you.
What do you mean? I've been married 14 years. My family loves me.
Your family loved Lawrence Secord,
she said with a sigh.
He died yesterday in a car crash. You're just an ex.
Oh, thank God you're dead, Lawrence, said Kimberly. If you'd lasted much longer, I probably would have poisoned your whiskey.
What? What's that supposed to mean?
It means I'm happy. For the first time in years.
His wife walked back into the dining room. She wore the red dress with the inappropriately low neckline and the just as inappropriately high slit up the side. From the looks of it, she wasn't wearing underwear either. She took a deep sip of champagne from the oversized goblet she'd answered the door with.
Well, I've been pretty happy when I'm with Danny, I guess.
Danny?
He was still dwelling on the dress and champagne in a goblet, and it took a few moments to process.
The pool boy?
Pool man, for your information.
Her grin was wicked.
A little after-the-fact advice, Lawrence. Stamina. Our wedded life would have been a lot more satisfying if you could have lasted longer than 3 minutes.
What are you?
Timed you. More than once.
She gestured at herself with her free hand.
Do you know what it's like being the most lusted-after woman at every social event and having to come home to 3 minute Larry? Our first time, Danny went for 16 minutes without even trying. After 11 years with you, it was like paradise.
11? You've been sleeping with the pool boy for the past 3 years?
She laughed and took another sip of champagne.
At least now we've got free run of the place. The pool house was getting kind of old.
You told me you were making an art studio out there.
Oh, he's an artist, believe me.
Lawrence clenched his fists.
I want you out.
What?
Out! His bellow shook the glasses hanging above the bar. Get out of my home!
Her smile was wide and beautiful.
You don't even realize, do you? Oh, this is delicious. All your political rants at every party, and you don't even know where you're standing, do you?
What are you talking about?
You're dead, Lawrence. You don't have a home. You don't have anything. I inherited it all when you died yesterday.
What?
You know how it goes. You damned exes don't get a thing. It's my house, my money, my everything. I signed all the paperwork this morning.
Kimberly downed the last of the champagne and gleefully threw the goblet to smash across the room.
Tell you what, out of the goodness of my heart, you can go up to the bedroom and pack a suitcase. Make sure you grab all of your cologne. You're already starting to stink.
Screw you.
Had your chance, darling. There are many limits to my vices, but necrophilia is one.
She pointed down the hall towards his study.
If you want to hang outside the window and watch, Danny's coming by in about an hour. I was going to ask him to bend me over your desk. When he takes me from behind, it's when he can go the longest.
He thought of a lot of things to say, but bit his tongue.
Oh, and in case you're having any naughty zombie thoughts, I might call the police and say I heard a prowler. They'd probably be here in 10 minutes or so.
She wandered back to the bar.
Just leave your keys on the hall table when you go.
In the back of his closet was an old gym duffel with a shoulder strap, bigger than most of his luggage and easier to carry. 4 of his better suits, some shirts, jeans, lots of socks and boxers. One of the scarves he wore to the opera went into the bag and the other he threw around his neck. He searched the bedroom and found a couple hundred split between 2 of Kimberly's purses, a bunch of 50s he kept hidden in an old book, some 20s and change from his nightstand, almost $1,000 in cash. He saw her wedding ring sitting on the bathroom sink and scooped it up. Then he stopped, reconsidered for a moment, and dumped her jewelry box into the duffel. Lawrence was 2 doors down the road when the police car passed him. He adjusted the scarf around his surgical scars and glanced over his shoulder as they pulled up to the house. Kimberly smiled and waved to them with another drink. He walked to the corner and stumbled once. His left foot was sluggish. The dead man held up his arm, and a taxi buzzed up. The teen at the wheel glanced back as the trunk popped open.
Where are you headed, sir?
He dropped the bag in the trunk.
I've been thrown out, my friend, he said. Take me somewhere nice for the night.
The driver took in his breath to ask something as Lawrence settled in behind the rearview mirror, then decided against it. The Horton Grand dominated downtown, a block-sized building 2 centuries old. The driver had been silent through the whole trip, but Lawrence gave him a large tip and tried not to notice as the teen flinched from his fingertips. He shouldered the strap of his bag and marched up the steps to the lobby. His toes caught once at the top, but he grabbed a railing and told himself he just looked like a drunk. The dark carpet and soft music soothed him in a few steps. The thought of a single malt scotch crossed his mind, and he tried to ignore the rumble from his stomach. Somehow he'd never noticed the valet exes on previous visits, even though there were 12 in the lobby. Each one had a black plastic muzzle winched over its head, half-hidden by the strap for a little red cap. Their wrists were handcuffed to their luggage racks. The well-dressed clerk at the desk, a slim man about Lawrence's age, saw him approach in the wide mirror and swung around like a dancer.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I was wondering if I could get a room for the night. Possibly a few nights. I'm afraid I don't have a reservation.
The other man made a show of opening an old-fashioned reservations book and running his finger down the page.
I believe we have some available, sir.
Card? He handed over the plastic and the clerk waved it across the scanner. His brow wrinkled just for a moment.
I'm sorry, sir. It's been declined.
Ah, said Lawrence. My fault. Please, try this one.
The card crossed the scanner panel, and the clerk shook his head again.
I am very sorry, sir.
What if I just pay cash?
I'm afraid we would still require a card for the room deposit.
I could pay the deposit in cash as well. There was a long silence as the other man studied Lawrence's face. He wondered if the scarf had slipped and berated himself for not checking it after the taxi drive.
Sir, said the well-dressed man, please forgive my bluntness, but are you dead?
He straightened up and squared his shoulders. I am, he said. What of it? The clerk closed the reservations book.
I'm afraid the Horton Grand has a very strict policy regarding ex-humans. I'm going to have to ask you to leave, sir.
A pair of large men in suits appeared at either end of the desk. Just outside the hotel lobby was an ATM. Lawrence paused at the kiosk and glared at the two security men. It took his card and he tapped in his 6-digit code. The machine hummed and flashed a message. I'm sorry, that account has been closed. Can I help you with something else? He muttered, switched to the savings account, and tried for another 1,000. I'm sorry, that account has been closed. Can I help you with something else? He banged his finger on the red button and held his hand out. This card is being held. Please contact the number on your statement about a replacement. Thank you for your business. He slammed his palm against the machine, but it had nothing else to say to him. Half the taxi drivers on the street glared at him. The others ignored him. When he shouted at them to give him a ride, a police officer jabbed him with a stun baton and he found himself on the ground. One of the drivers tried to peel off his watch and he yanked it away from the man.
Shame to see a nice watch like that on a dead guy, said the driver to his friend.
Real shame, nodded the other man. They followed him to the end of the block before they got bored and wandered back to their vehicles. It took an hour to cross the city, trying every hotel along the way. The icy woman at the Hyatt threatened to call the police before a group of drunken conventioneers dragged him out to the street. The doorman at the Marriott wouldn't let him in. Security at the Sands grabbed him halfway across the lobby. The old motel on 11th offered him a supply closet until morning for $200, but the kid behind the counter wanted to lock him in. Another half hour and he found himself on the outskirts of the park. When he realized how far he'd gone, he congratulated himself on being in great shape at 44. Then he remembered the real reason he wasn't out of breath. A monument loomed there, 4 bronze figures on a marble base. It had been old when he was still young. The statues were the heroes of the outbreak 100 years ago, the Zombocalypse, as it was called. He couldn't remember all their names, but the tall man was named George, which he always remembered as a child because it was an awkward first name to grow up with, like Homer. The woman had been some kind of celebrity. He knew the huge robot looming behind them was named after a dog. The base of the pedestal had 4 thick buttresses which made a set of nooks sheltered from the wind. He tossed his duffel into one of the spaces and wished he'd packed a blanket. Something slipped in the grass behind the monument. An X stumbled into sight, a dead woman with patches of oily hair. Its body was gaunt and wasted, its skin the color of old newspaper. One eye was an empty, withered socket. Each bare foot dragged behind it as it walked, a swollen sock of meat and bones it didn't know enough to lift. Lawrence flinched back from the dead thing. It had a muzzle, but even from here he could see the plastic was white and brittle. There was a splash of yellow across the X's side, a paintball marking it for a pickup. Its lopsided path was curving it around to his duffel, and he was struck with the thought of it tripping and falling on him while he slept. The dead woman shuffled alongside the statues, and her one-eyed gaze passed over him without interest. He took a cautious step forward and tried to remember all the X-safety classes from school. There was a rhyme about fright and sight they drilled into kids until 6th grade, one most of them forgot by 8th. Another careful step put him next to it. The X still didn't react. He put his hands on the woman, tried not to think about the greasy way her clothes slid on her arms, and turned her away from the monument and away from him. The dead thing paused for a moment, as if confused by the shift in view. Then it stumbled forward, still dragging each foot as it staggered away. The off-kilter movement would carry the dead thing out onto Park Boulevard in a while, and into traffic. Lawrence took a moment of pleasure in the thought of the ex getting splattered by a car and then noticed his own papery hand. He sighed and looked up at the statues.
You'd all kill me on sight, wouldn't you?
He hunkered down out of the wind and tried to get comfortable. In the morning, everything would be better. He'd go into the office, throw himself into the Hammond account, and have his secretary rent him a little place somewhere. Everything was going to be fine. He was stretched out with his head on the duffel bag for an hour before he realized he didn't sleep anymore.
Mr. Secord?
The woman at the front desk yelped.
Good morning, Judy.
But you're... They said...
He tilted his head at her. Is there a problem?
No,
she yelped.
Just let me get Mr. Parson.
She pressed a few buttons and whispered into her headset. As he waited, he saw his reflection in the big glass doors that led to the inner office. He glanced at his hand and saw his skin was the soft gray of thick clouds. The fingernails looked pale in contrast. His calves were sore. 3 minutes later, the doors hissed open and Ray Parson strolled out, 6 feet of color-treated hair and pearly veneers.
Lawrence! He held out a hand, then changed his mind. Sweet, sexy Jesus, so the stories are true.
He tried to smile.
I guess. What stories are they telling you, Ray?
Just that you had a car crash and turned into a man-eating monster?
That's about half right.
Ha! Barked Ray. Well, what can I do for you? You here for your stuff?
My...
He blinked and felt his lids drag on his eyes.
I'm here to work. We're really close on the Hammond account.
His boss's grin flickered for a moment.
To work?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure we can close it this week. You can't afford to lose me.
Well, no, Lawrence, no, I sure can't, he said. Thing is, you don't work here anymore. He's not the best, but I had to put Greg on the Hammond account.
What?
He counted to three and lowered his voice.
You're firing me?
Well, not exactly, said Ray. I mean, you died.
Not really.
Okay, sort of.
Oh, come on,
his former employer said.
How many times did you and I talk about just this sort of thing over drinks? The dead taking jobs from the living, trying to destroy our way of life.
That's ridiculous. You know me.
Used to. I have to be honest, you're...
He chose some words.
Your new legal status has a lot of people here worried, Lawrence. There are trust issues, and we have to think of our clients. Are they going to do business with a company that employs...
Portfolio specialists?
Zombies, he said. Let's just call a spade a spade. You're one of the walking dead, and no one's going to feel comfortable around you. Heck, my skin's crawling a bit just looking at you.
I'm the same guy. Jesus, Ray, I was going to be Anna's godfather.
Good thing that didn't happen, eh? Can you imagine trying to explain that to her now? She'd want to keep you as a pet or something.
He shook his head.
Was good working with you, Lawrence. Your stuff's in the break room. We got it all into two boxes, but I think Greg may have stolen your stapler.
Marty?
On the screen, his friend peered at the camera.
Lawrence? Is that you?
Yeah, it's me.
This isn't your extension. Why can't I see you?
I'm using the break room phone and the video's broken, I think.
He pressed his thumb against the lens a little harder.
Look, have you talked to Kimberly recently?
On the other end of the link, Marty shifted in his seat.
No,
he said. You two having a fight?
Yeah, sort of.